is Over the Garden Gate, a program brought to you by the University of California Cooperative Extension Master Gardener Program of Tuolumne County. The mission of the UCCE Master Gardeners is to provide research-based gardening information to the public. If you would like to contact our Master Gardener Program, please call our hotline, which is area code 209-533-5912. The hotline is not manned full-time, but we do pick up our messages and we will get back to you within the week.
Hello, everybody. This is Debbie Powell. I'm the Master Gardener Coordinator for both Calaveras and Tuolumne County. We are so fortunate for our virtual open garden to have Sue Mosbacher as our presenters for our topic called Preserving Your Harvest. In charge of the Master Food Preserver Program and also the Master Gardener Program, at this moment, she is the acting statewide coordinator, and that covers Sacramento, El Dorado County, Amador County, Calaveras, and Calaveras County. She was certified as a Master Food Preserver back in 2011, so she's got some experience under her belt besides all the other qualifying experiences. How about if you just take it away?
All right, okay. I'm going to talk, I say briefly, we'll see how that goes, about high acid canning. And the basic thing that we do with high acid canning is we put the food in the jars, we get rid of air bubbles, we wipe the jar rims, we put on the lids, we process it or we cook it in the canner, we let the jars cool, we remove the rings, wash the jars, and then we have a shelf-stable product. And so again, the reason that we're doing the canning is to make sure that we kill all foodborne pathogens that are in the jars. So this is the gist of what we're gonna do. I'm gonna quickly go over canning tools. We've got funnels, that's how you get the food in the jar. There's some funnels where they sit inside the jar, some gentle funnels sit on the edge of the jar. We've got ladles to get the product in there, headspace measurer. The recipes will say you need a certain amount of headspace, and that's between the food, between the jar, the space between the food and the top of the jar. And so, and a debubbler. You can either flip this upside down or you can use chopsticks or a separate tool to get rid of the bubbles in the jar. We have lids and rings. For the most part, we use the two-piece metal lid. And so there's the metal lid, it has a gasket on the bottom, and when we can, this gasket sits on top of the jar ring and it gets very soft during the canning. You take it out of the jar, when it cools, it hardens, and that's what completes the seal. You use these one time, and then we have rings. And if you've been canning for a while, you may not have read the box for your lids, but it says, you know, they're for one-time use, wash lids in hot soapy water, rinse well, and then set aside until ready for use. It used to be that you had to have them heated in boiling water. You don't need to do that anymore. The gasket material has been changed over the last 5-10 years, so it softens up just by putting it in the canner for even, you know, 5 to 10 minutes. So you don't have to worry about that. And then the jar lifter. This is how you take the jars in and out of the canners. You lift them straight up, straight over, and straight down. You go through all this work to clean your jars. You don't want to tilt them and put food on the jar rims. So those are the basic tools. And then the equipment that we use. Most people, when they think of canning, they think of an old enamel boiling water canner. Works great. It has a rack inside where you can put the jars in, then you lower them down into the water. The water covers the jars when you can it. You're processing it, the water is above the jars, below the jars, and around the jars, and got the heat penetration. So that's the most common canner. There's newer models out there. This one here has a stainless steel bottom, so it'll work on an induction burner, but you don't even have to have a canner. You can just use a pot. You just need to make sure you have a rack on the bottom of the pot so the jars are not sitting on the bottom of the pot. And so that way you've got a little bit of space for water to go underneath the jars, and it protects the jars from the heat source. And so you can use any pot as long as it's deep enough. And if you don't have a rack for the bottom of the canner, you can take canning rings and twist tie them together and put them on the bottom of the pot and keep the jars off the bottom. So that's the basics for a boiling water canner. It's basically a pot. So now there's also steam canners. And I've got two variations here. You use the exact same recipes that you do for boiling water canning. People used to use steam canners a lot. And then a while ago, there was some concern that there might be pockets of cold air, and it wasn't one of the recommended canners. But in 2015, there was a couple of universities that got some grant money and tested it, and they proved that it is safe to use. This is my preferred method. I call it drought-tolerant canning because you only use a couple of inches of water, and it takes a lot less time to bring a couple of inches of water to boil than a full canner. How this one works is we have a rack. It sits up a little bit. You can see on both of these models here, the rack is up about 2 inches or so. And so you fill the water just above the rack. You put your jars in there, you put the lid on there. You boil the water. When water boils, it makes steam. When the lid fills up with steam, you can't see it in this picture, but there's a little vent hole. This one has two vent holes on opposite sides, and steam is forced out of the canner. And so when you have a steady steam of stream coming out of the vent, that little vent port or hole, then you know you have a pure steam environment and you can start canning. This model here, it has a sensor on the top and it has a little needle. And when the needle is in the green for your elevation, it should coincide when you have a steady steam of stream coming out the side of the canner. And so it's time to can or start your processing time. When you've got one of these, you can check and you'll know how accurate it is by just use. And you can tell, yep, I've got all the steam coming out and at the same time as my gauge is over in this little knob range, the green zone. So that works out well. This is a handy reference tool, but you want to make sure that it coincides with the steam. The steam is the most important part. And then there's one company, Victorio, that makes a multi-use canner, a boiling water pot. And it has, you can see there's a rack on the bottom. It has vent holes and it has one of the dial gauges. So you can use it for a boiling water canner because there's some tomato recipes that you can use that are, you know, 50 to 60 minutes. And one of the restrictions on the steam canner is you can only process things for a maximum of 45 minutes. And that's just because you may run out of water if you boil it too long. And so if you have something that takes a long time, you need to use a boiling water canner. So this product here, it has a boiling water canner. And then what you do is you could take that rack, you flip it upside down, and then you put it upside down in the canner, fill your water above the rack, and then you can use it as a steam canner. I like to put another rack on top. I use a pizza pan that I turn upside down, and it has holes all along the bottom to give me a uniform flat surface to put my jars in, because otherwise there's too many little spots where my jars could tip. But anyway, we've got three different styles of canners: boiling water, aka a pot, a steam canner, and then a multi-use canner that does both. So when we're prepping our food, we're going to put it in our jars, and it'll either call for a raw pack or a hot pack. Raw pack, you put raw food in the jars, in the hot jars. Hot pack, you put cooked food in the jars. They both have boiling liquid poured over them. The raw pack is faster, but you'll get more float. That's where the product rises to the top of the jar when you take it out of the canner. And that's because there's natural air in the food and it hasn't been driven out. When you do a hot pack, you cook the food and so it removes the air from the food and it makes it more pliable. You can fit more product in the jar so you'll have less float. It also is basically like blanching it beforehand, and the color will actually stay brighter and more vibrant longer in the jar, and it helps with the flavor. It's like I said, it's blanching it before you put it in there. The only drawback is it takes a little bit more work because you have to cook the food before you put it in, but it's maybe 5 minutes. So a hot pack is the recommended way, but you can do whichever you want. When recipes say for a hot pack, do this, for a raw pack, do this. But if it only gives you a hot pack choice, that's all you do. And so I have a couple of examples here. We had a volunteer who made some spiced apple rings, and she did a raw pack and a hot pack. And on the hot pack, you can see she was able to fit more product in here. We still have a little bit of float, that's the space here, but not much. She had used one of those spiralizers to cut her apples, and they fit perfectly in the jar. So this is the raw pack where she put them in raw. And as you can see, there's a lot more float, and the jar is kind of rearranged because they change shape and they shrunk a little bit as they were cooking in the canner. It doesn't look quite as nice. There's no food safety differences. It's really just cosmetic and the amount of product you can get in the jar. but this is what it means when they talk about a raw pack or a hot pack. Okay, headspace, I talked about a little bit before. It's the space between the product and the lid. If you have too little, because you're going to cram every last bit of product in that jar, the food may bubble out and over onto the jar rim during processing, and you may not have a good seal because you don't have a clean rim anymore. If you have too much headspace, because you figure, I'm not going to find another jar, and let's see how it seals. You may not get all the air out of the jar during the canning process, and you may have a very weak seal. And so there are a lot of times I will go ahead and can a jar that has too much headspace if I don't have a smaller jar that fits it perfectly. And then when it's done, I stick it in the refrigerator because I'm expecting the seal to fail. Okay, a couple of just very quick things on pickled products. Pickled products use vinegar. The most common pickled products are with vegetables, and vegetables are a low acid food. And so if you acidify them with vinegar, you make it a high acid food, and you can can them in a boiling water or a steam canner. But you need to make sure that you use a vinegar that's 5% acidity and read the label. Rice vinegars are not 5%. You can find some bargain brands from other countries that may not be 5%. Make sure that it's 5%. And again, looking at grandma's old recipe, check the quantities. I always tell people, find a current recipe and then use grandma's spices, because vinegar used to be 7% acidity, and then long before that it was 15% acidity. So the proportions of water and vinegar in your recipes may not be assuming that you've got a 5% acidity here. So current recipe, grandma's spices. And you can use any type of vinegar, or white vinegar, white wine vinegar, red wine, apple cider. I like to make my pickled products with white wine vinegar. I think it gives it a smoother flavor. I've used champagne vinegar too, which has even higher acidity for a different flavor. The white and the wine have a consistent color. If you use red wine vinegar or apple cider vinegar, it's going to change a lot of things. Not the food safety, just the color and the flavor. And then when you're doing pickling, you want to make sure that you use canning salt. It's pure salt, and you'll see the only ingredient will be salt. If your salt has yellow prussiate of soda, it's an anti-caking agent. What that will do is make your brine cloudy, and then you look at it and you think, is something growing in there? My brine should be beautifully clear. So you don't want to use any anti-caking agents. And also, the recipes call for canning salt, and you need to know that canning salt is much more dense than kosher salt. If you look at these two boxes here, and they're kind of representative of what they are in real life, this is a 4-pound box. It's very small and heavy. And then the kosher salt is, the boxes are quite a bit bigger, but they're only 3 pounds. And so if you measure out half a cup of salt, you're going to have actually less salt by weight if you're using kosher salt than canning salt. So you want to be using canning salt for the pickled products. Otherwise, if you could only use kosher salt, then you need to use it by weight. And I have, and I don't remember off the top of my head what we had found when we did our substitutions in the handout. Okay, going to switch to jams and jellies real fast. So when you make a jam or a jelly recipe, one of the first things that new canners say is, oh my goodness, all that sugar. There's a purpose for having all the sugar in the jam and jelly, and it's not just to make it taste sweet. It's actually the preservative, or it's the bodyguard of your jam. What it does at the molecular level is it binds with the water molecules. So the sugar and the water molecules bind together, and it's lowering the water activity, but essentially the water is not available for the pathogens to grow. If the pathogens can't grow, they can't make mold, they can't make fuzz and slime. So that's why we put the sugar in there. It also brightens the color and makes it pretty nice. And you want to follow the recipe. If you want to use a sugar substitute, you can't use a regular recipe. You need to make sure you use one that calls for low or no sugar and the appropriate pectin, which we'll talk about in a moment. Sugar substitutes, all they do is sweeten. They do not preserve. So there's no little bodyguard in your sugars or in your jams and jellies when you use the sugar substitutes. And your sugar substitutes need to be stable at high heat. So there's really only three that are recommended for canning: your honey, Splenda, and stevia. The others are not, they will not work with the heat. So this is what you can use. Okay, so pectins. So pectins and the sugars, they work together. So most of your recipes out there, not most, but the most common recipes are for full sugar jams or jellies, and they call for just a regular pectin. What's required is the sugar and the gel to work to the sugar and the pectin to work together to make the gel. And so if you decide there's just way too much sugar, I'm going to cut the amount of sugar that I have in this recipe, it will still taste wonderful, but you won't have a jam or a jelly. You'll have a syrup because you need the amount of sugar in the recipe and the amount of pectin to make the gel. If you want to cut down the amount of sugar, you need to use a low sugar recipe and it will use a low sugar pectin. And those products use calcium to make the gel, not the sugar. And so when you're adding sugar or Splenda, it's just for flavoring. It's, again, it's not the preservative. A key thing to remember is when you make a low sugar product like this, you don't have the preservative in there. So while it's canned, you've sterilized it so nothing's going to grow. But once you open it, even if you store it in the refrigerator, within a few weeks, it will start to mold because you don't have the sugar preservative. So I've got some examples here. There's the Sure Gel and Mrs. Wages. They have regular pectin. The pink box is the low sugar box, low sugar product. Ball's pectin used to be in boxes, but now they're in bulk containers. And when you peel back the little lid, it tells you for every two jars you want to make, here's how much sugar and pectin. And they have a low sugar version as well. And then there's another product out there called Pomona's Universal Pectin. And all these three here, the Sure Gel, the Ball, and the Pomona, they all use calcium to make the gel because it's a low sugar product. And the Pomona Pectin, it has a separate calcium packet. And so there's an extra step to make some calcium water. And then their recipes say, add this many teaspoons of calcium water and this many teaspoons of pectin. Pomona Pectin, you have to use their recipes because they're all science experiments. And then there's a couple of brands that also make a liquid pectin. And if you have a recipe for liquid pectin, you have to use a liquid pectin. You can't use any of the powdered pectins because the chemistry is completely different and the timing is different. You add the powdered pectins at the beginning of the can or the cooking process, and the liquid pectins get added at the end. So two different worlds. And then most of the powdered pectins and even the liquid pectins, you can make products and put them into the freezer. Some of them have some no cook methods. Ball also has a freezer pectin. It's called an instant pectin. It's the easiest thing in the world. You take sugar and your pectin, you stir it together, and then you mix in your crushed fruit. You stir it for 3 minutes and you're done. There's no cooking involved. And so since you're not cooking the product, the color is bright and vibrant. And then you store it in the freezer, take it out, stick it in the fridge when you're ready to eat it. It's wonderful. But the big thing to remember on all of these is follow the recipe. Use the right amount of sugar, use the correct pectin, and follow the process, and then you'll have a good product. You're making jam, but you are also doing a science experiment. Okay, a couple of things on tomatoes. We acidify all tomatoes, always, even if you're gonna be pressure canning. Tomatoes, they're borderline acidic and non-acidic, and it varies so much. The just general rule of thumb is always acidify so that you are guaranteed a safe product. And add it to the jars before adding the tomatoes. So that way you can look in all your jars and say, okay, I filled them all, and now I can put my tomatoes in. If we just added the acid, either lemon juice, citric acid, or vinegar, and I'll show you in a moment the quantities, if you just add it to the big pot, you don't know if you have enough in each jar. So we add it to the jars individually, then add the tomatoes, and then you're set. So how much? Here's the amounts. So for quarts and pints, it's 2 tablespoons of bottled lemon juice. And again, it's bottled lemon juice because it's guaranteed to be 5% acidity, or 1/2 teaspoon of citric acid, or you can use vinegar. Citric acid is the one that impacts the flavor the least. I've been using lemon juice. I like the resulting flavor, but I'm going to try some jars with vinegar this year because I read that someone who had made it, well, she didn't have lemon juice or citric acid, so I've got a can of tomatoes today, so she used vinegar. And she said after about 6 months, the flavor was actually enhanced and she liked the flavor of it. So I'm going to try a couple jars with vinegar this year and see how I like the final product. Okay, salsa is a fun thing. So you can make some adjustments to salsa. Most of the time we tell you follow the recipe exactly, but you can make some changes with salsa. And so with tomatoes and peppers, You can make changes as far as the variety goes, but not the quantity. So if it says 4 cups of tomatoes, you can use any kind of tomato that you want. If it calls for 2 cups of peppers, if you like your salsa hot, you can put in some ghost peppers or jalapenos, habaneros, whatever you want. But the quantity needs to stay the same. And the same thing for onions. But remember, scallions are not considered onions in this case. So you wouldn't add scallions. But you can put sweet onions, Vidalia onions, yellow onions, red onions, whatever you want. So the quantity stays the same. The variety is what you can change. Okay, with acids, we're going to be using vinegar or commercial lemon or lime juice. And I have this marked in red because Ball's most recent cookbook has recipes for fresh lemon juice, but the most current USDA testing doesn't support that, and we haven't been able to get test results from Ball. So I know our specialists are trying to get funding to do testing to see if fresh lemon juice can be used, but until then, we use commercial lemon juice or lime juice. So things that you can switch. If the recipe calls for vinegar, you can swap lemon or lime juice instead of the vinegar, the same proportions. If it calls for lemon or lime juice and you want to use vinegar, you can't, because the vinegar is not as acidic as the lemon or lime juice. So you can't go from lemon lime to vinegar, but you can go from vinegar to lemon and lime. You're actually adding more acidity that way. And then spices, this is where you get to play. You can adjust dried spice type and quantity. So you can have any spice varieties that you want in there. They're all dried ingredients. That way you can have your secret blends that everybody just raves about. Quantity for the tomatoes, peppers, and onions, you can swap lemon and lime instead of vinegar and then go crazy on your own custom spice blends. A quick note, since we are not living at sea level, all recipes that you'll find in cookbooks and canning books are designed at sea level for the processing time. At sea level, water boils at 212. The higher up you go, it's not going to get to 212. So what we have to do is we can it longer since we can't get to 212 degrees. All the recipes at the National Center for Home Food Preservation and in our handout list the processing time for different elevation ranges. Most of the time when you're looking at canning books, even if they're based on a reputable recipe or based on research, most of them don't say, here's, you know, all the different elevation ranges. They'll just say process for 15 minutes. And then some of them will say adjust for altitude. But if you don't do it all the time, you got to go back and find the section where it tells you how to process it. So make sure that when you're canning, if you're higher than 1,000 feet, you know how much time you're supposed to add. And this is just a general cheat sheet. Okay. I'm almost done. All right, so I want to go over quickly the process for the boiling water canner. And one of the handout items that I'll be giving you, posting online, is a cheat sheet of the steps for boiling water and steam canning. I like to take them and put them in a plastic sleeve and just stick them on my canner. So that way I've got a reminder, and it works well for people who are new to canning, so they have a checklist of things to go through. So we start with a reputable recipe. You're going to prep your food and heat your jars. Put them in the canner to heat them. I've had people say, well, I want to, you know, heat them in the dishwasher. Well, you can, but you've got a canner going there and you put the jars that you're going to use, put them in your canner. So you want to heat the canner water, not to boiling. If you're doing a hot pack, you want it to be simmering at about 180 degrees. A raw pack, it's cooler at 140 degrees, so it's hot water. But you want to be able to bring the water and the temperature inside the jar, since it's raw food, up to the temperature together. Then you're going to put your jars in the canner. They're going to have 1 to 2 inches of water over the top of the jars. Remember that headspace measurer, you can use that to double check that you've got enough water in the jars. For longer processing times, over 30 minutes, that's when you want to have 2 inches of water, because you don't want the water to boil down and get too low. So your jars are in there, they're on the rack. You put the lid on, you crank up the heat to high, and then you wait till the water boils. And when you have a vigorous boil, you start your timer, because your recipe will say process for 10 minutes, 15 minutes, however long. You're gonna make sure that you adjust for altitude, so you may be processing for 20 minutes instead of 15. And then you're gonna adjust the heat. You wanna get a gentle boil. I like to describe it as a smooth jazz boil, not a heavy metal acid rock and roll boil. It's the same temperature. And if you have a very vigorous boil, you may be shaking your jars around in the canner. They may bang into each other. They may fall over. So all you need is a smooth, gentle boil. It's the same temperature. And then when the timer goes off, you turn the heat off and you take the lid off, and then you wait 5 minutes. And it's just so things can settle down and cool down, and it helps with the float in the jars. And then after 5 minutes, then you take the jars out, and then you cool them on the counter, put them on a towel or a cutting board or a tray, something to protect them from the cold surface, and you let them cool for 12 to 24 hours. And then after that, you take the rings off, you wash your jars, you label them, and you stick them in the cupboard. And so one of the links we'll be giving you is to an MFP video library and our statewide website. And it has a collection of videos from extension offices around the country. Some of them are a few years old, and so they will still talk about preheating the lids and things like that, but you'll still be able to see the process. So that's how you do boiling water canning. And I'm gonna quickly go over steam canning. Again, you use the reputable recipes, you heat the water, the jars go in the canner, and remember the water just goes above the rack down here. Put the lid on, high heat. So now you wait for that steady column of steam. And when you've got that, you start timing. And it should be the same time as your temperature sensor is in the green zone. Again, you adjust for altitude, so you may need to process longer than the recipe calls for. And you've got a maximum of 45 minutes for processing time. If you had a higher elevation and your adjustments for altitude put you at canning something for 60 minutes, then you need to use a boiling water canner. So again, you adjust the heat. You want a smooth jazz boil. If you have a really heavy boil, you may see that the lid pops up a little bit and it'll kind of float. Sometimes it does something called a burp, and it will lift up enough to let out some steam, but it sucks in some air as well. And so you want to make sure that you've got a nice tight fit and that the lid stays down. And then when the timer goes off, you just turn the heat off. Don't take the lid off. That would be the same thing as taking the jars out immediately. So just let everything settle in there. Leave the lid on for no more than 3 minutes. So 2 to 3 minutes. And then the lid comes off away from you. Take the jars out. Again, put them on the counter on a towel or some kind of protected surface and let them cool. If any of the jars don't seal, then you put them in the refrigerator. Some products you can reprocess, but depending on what it is, the quality, if you're cooking it twice, may not be as what you're looking for. So usually it's just put it in the refrigerator, and that's what you're having for dinner the next couple of days. Let's see, so got the salsa. So the handouts that you guys are going to get, that'll be online, and you'll have the email link sent to you. The food safety basics, freezing, dehydrating, core canning, and then actually I put all of them in one, so you don't have to do, so you can have them all in one document. I've got the document on fruit spread, so it talks about sugars and pectins and making juice. I have one on pickling fruits and vegetables, so it gives you a lot more information about that. And then the 25 pages of recipes, and I'm also going to include canning cheat sheets. And so just we'll list the steps. And then we'll also give you the links to the recordings, and then the link to the video library. It's on the statewide Master Food Preserver site, and a link to the National Center for Home Food Preservation. There's lots and lots of great information. Let's see, I think that's it. We've been answering questions as we go. I think we're a little overambitious. Next time, Debbie, I need to just pick one topic.
This is all really wonderful information. Sue, can you talk about some of your classes, your future classes that you're planning to do?
Debbie mentioned upcoming classes. We're working on that. This was kind of a practice session for us. At this time, we aren't allowed to meet in groups. And so we're trying to put together a couple more online classes. The statewide Master Food Preserver site has classes that are around the country, or not around the country, across California. So when other Master Food Preservers are doing virtual classes, we'll list them there as well. And we're working on putting a couple more online classes. I don't have any dates yet. We just gotta get people trained and comfortable to do the videos. Ask a Master Food Preserver on our website.
You've been listening to Over the Garden Gate, a program presented by the UCCE Master Gardeners of Tuolumne County. I'm Linda Reevely. Thank you for being with us.